are listening to The Stick and Hack Show, a show about golf and life from a stick and a hack. Now, here is your host, Adam Grubb and Mike Ryan.
All right, everybody, welcome into The Stick and Hack Show. Happy to have you here. This is quite possibly the greatest golf show in the free world. From the greatest golf club in the world without the course, I'm your host, Adam Grubb, and that's Mike Ryan over there. Mike, how are you?
Super duper, bud.
Guest today, Steve Scott. Now, that name might sound familiar to you. If you're a golf fan, if you're a Tiger fan, if you are a fan of good men and good people, Steve Scott will come up in your mind. He's the founder of the Silver Club Golfing Society, as well as a pro and co-author of Hey Tiger, You Need to Move Your Mark Back, which will be released May 18th of this year. It's an incredible story. For those of you that don't know it, you're going to hear all about it here in a second. And his book comes out in about a week or so. So it's Hey Tiger, You Need to Move Your Mark Back. And we'll get to that story here in just a second. Steve Scott is the guest. So, Mike, that brings us to the topic of the day, which is sportsmanship. Yep. Okay. Now, you and I have played golf together and many, many times. And I don't want to alarm anybody here. But you're not as you're a good sport. That's right.
I am.
You're pretty good.
I was like, where are you going with this?
You're pretty good. Sportsmanship in golf is forever linked. And
yeah.
And it's a gentleman's game. The rules. Classic Shane. Already.
Yeah, he's already dropping stuff.
2 minutes
making
in.
Making noises.
2 minutes
he can't
in.
Help himself.
It is forever linked with the term sportsmanship, but there are some great stories of sportsmanship that I want to get to here. At the infamous 1936 Olympics in Berlin, Jesse Owens, the American world record holder in the long jump, had foot faulted twice in his bid to qualify for the final. With his rival clearly worried, Germany's Luz Long, the European record holder, offered Owens advice on how to adjust his run-up to make the qualifying distance. Owens' next jump was a success, and he went on to win the gold medal with Long earning silver. The guy that gave him the tip got second. Owen said later, you can melt down all the medals and cups that I have, and they wouldn't be a plating on the 24-carat friendship that I felt for Luz Long at that moment. So he gave him advice and said, hey, here's what you do. The dude then beat him.
Yeah, I laugh because, a lot of the time when we're talking about sportsmanship anymore, it's like we feel like golf kind of has like the market cornered on that. But
right.
I mean, there's so many great stories across other sports where just sportsmanship in general that, especially in a situation like that, like if you're that competitive, it's hard sometimes to really, give somebody else advice. And that's a great story.
John Landy of Australia is known as the second man to ever break the 4 minute mile. It was an achievement most people believed was not possible, but he did it only 46 days after the Englishman Roger Bannister. During the 1956 Australian National Championships, Landy was in the midst of a race when a competitor, 19-year-old Ron Clark, fell before him. Landy initially jumped over Clark, but scraped him with his cleats on the try. Landy stopped to make sure Clark was okay before rejoining the race and still managed to finish first in 4 minutes and 4 seconds.
That's just, the sportsmanship's great, but like the fact that he still won.
He's like, he took a break. He took 10 minutes to make sure the dude was okay. Took him to the hospital, came back and still won. Western Oregon senior Sarah Tukalski. That's not right. It's not even close.
I'm going to guess it's Tukalski.
Good for you. Sarah is her name. She hit the first home run of her college career and promptly tore her ACL while running around the bases. If she'd been replaced on the field by a substitute runner, her long ball would have been reduced to simply a single. And if any of Sarah's teammates touched her, she would have been called out. So members of the opposing team carried her around the bases. It wasn't a pretty trot around the bags, but it was an inspiring one. You can find that one on YouTube, and it is a hair on your arms tearjerker.
Yeah, I love that.
And that brings us to story number four. In August of 1996, Steve Scott went head-to-head against Tiger Woods at Pumpkin Ridge Golf Club in the finals of the U.S. Amateur Championship, a club, by the way, I've played, sir.
It's exciting.
Thank you.
I have not.
Well, 5,345 players whittled down to two. Scott found himself a surprising five up after the first 18, but at hole 35, Tiger squared the grueling match with an improbable 40-foot birdie putt, one of many for Tiger. With the result coming down to the last hole, the difference in the outcome actually came earlier, when Scott reminded Woods to move his mark back to its rightful place on hole 34. So he marked his ball and then had to move it so that it wasn't in Steve's line. And then when he got ready to putt and he came out behind the ball, Steve said, "Hey, Tiger, move your mark back.
Yeah.
Had Scott not done the morally correct thing, Tiger would have been penalized and in turn not have won three straight U.S. amateur championships, something that not even the great Jack Nicklaus, legendary Bobby Jones, had done, forever changing the course of Tiger's career and golf history. Our guest today is that man, Steve Scott. Steve, welcome in to the Stick and Hack Show.
What a great lead-in, guys. Thank you very much. That was wonderful.
Well, we are very happy to have you here, and your story is the epitome of sportsmanship, of class, of a friendship that was melded together on the biggest stage, the U.S. Amateur, against the biggest golfer of that time. Now, this was his third run at an amateur championship. I'm going to read your bio here so people know a little bit more about you, because that is not just all that you've done. You didn't just play Tiger and tell him to move his mark back. You've had an illustrious career. You're a PGA head golf pro at the Outpost Club, and you're founder of the Silver Club Golfing Society. You have a passion for the overall business and teaching portion of the game of golf, but you have enjoyed appearances as on-course commentator with PGA Tour Live, Fox Sports, and the Golf Channel, as an in-studio guest and live instructional contributor. You're also a contributor in print publications such as Golf Week, Golf Digest, and PGA Magazine, and you still play golf competitively in some fashion. You frequent the PGA professional events in the Carolinas, the PGA section, and you won the 2018 CPGA Championship as well as the CPGA Player of the Year. Steve Scott is on the Stick and Hack Show. My first question for you, Steve, is 1996, you told Tiger to move his ball mark back, thus allowing him the victory. What were you thinking?
Yeah, well, you know what? I think the answer is I wasn't thinking, and in a good way though, and I mean that in the most sincere form, because you know golf is one of those sports where, as a junior, as you come up, when you come up in the ranks as a junior, you hopefully, you know, your parents teach you the right things to do, or your teachers or what have you, and I think for me in that moment, it was such an instinctive reflex action, right? And so I wasn't really thinking, because it was just something that I've done before, and I would have done it, you know, playing Saturday morning with the guys or whatnot. I mean, but it just happened to be in the U.S. Amateur Finals in a ultra pivotal moment where, you know, I mean, me as the underdog, I'm down. I'm two up. Excuse me. And this moment really wouldn't matter had I not been two up at the time in the hole. I mean, if I win that hole, I win the match. And so I'm thinking, okay, if I birdie this hole and something great happens, and, you know, Tiger just, you know, his ball, it's amazing the probabilities. I go into this in the book a little bit, but it's amazing the probabilities of when you're playing a two person, you know, one-on-one match, and all the spots that his ball could have been in relation to my ball on the green. I mean, the green's pretty big. And so you think really fate has something to do with everything that happens in our lives. Certainly Tiger, now looking back 25 years, you think, you know, wow, that was, you know, a pretty pivotal moment in his career. And, you know, not that he wouldn't have gone on and won 15 major championships. But I think his confidence could have been changed and shaken at that moment had he lost, had he played from the wrong spot, lost to the U.S. Amateur and that run for history on what would ultimately have been a bonehead moment. It would have been really interesting change of events, and, you know, history would have been different in some fashion. You know, would he gone on and won the Masters eight months later?
Yeah. Is it weird still for you to have that career defining moment and to be forever linked with the greatest golfer of all time?
I don't think it's weird. I think it's great. I mean, look, everybody would love to play with the greats of the game. I've been fortunate enough to play with Jack Nicklaus in the practice round of the Masters the following spring myself. I've played against Tiger Woods. I've shook the hand of Arnold Palmer twice. You know, I've been able to be around and play golf with the greats of the game. And so, to be linked with a Tiger Woods, arguably, you know, the greatest player of our generation, man, I mean, it's an honor. And then the way it all went down, I mean, it's pretty surreal to think that I was that guy in that moment.
Yeah, you didn't mention the Stick and Hack Show on there, but we'll forgive you.
Someday he'll be telling people. Someday.
I shook the hand of Arnie, and I was on the Stick and
Right,
Hack Show.
Right. Steve, tell us about the book. You know, why after 25 years did you decide to tell this story?
Well, I mean, the timing is pretty interesting. I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention my co-writer, Trip Bowden, who's a fantastic writer, wrote a book about 12 years ago called Freddie and Me. He was the first white caddy at Augusta National back in the late 80s, and he wrote a story about his friendship with Freddie Bennett at Augusta National. And so Tripp's involvement in the book and the timing of me, him and I really coming together was December of 2019. And I had him in for my Silver Club Golfing Society to do a book talk and signing at one of my events in Augusta, because I wanted to connect all of my players to Augusta. And I ended up telling him my story that night at the beginning of December 19. And he says, I got to write this story. And so we kind of started on the journey, in January, February of 20. And then the pandemic comes around. And so we have a lot of time to sit around. I mean, the timing, honestly, it's pretty amazing how, you know, the amount of time that it takes to write a book. And, you know, Tripp did all the writing, but we talked for tens, if not hundreds of hours, it felt like, about everything. And he just, you know, got my voice and put it into the book and put the sizzle in it. And it's just a tremendous process and really, really just a cool process to get it all done. And the timing with the pandemic kind of, it allowed us even more time to really dive into the nuts and bolts of the story.
I can just see. Oh my God. I need like a year of just being at home to write this book. If the world could just
shut down
for a year, I'd be able to do this project. Oh no.
Right?
Now I have to do it. Tell us a bit about the book in general and the story. I mean, because I think it should be a very short book. Like, hey, this happened. I told him, he did, and now look at him, and here's where I'm at. But there's a lot that goes into that. There's a lot that goes into the book and your story and where you are today and how golf has really been that major vein of your bloodstream forever. Tell us about the overarching storyline that the book brings and why people would want to understand and know more about you, but more about that story.
Right. Yeah. Great question. I mean, on the surface, really, yeah, you'd think this might be just a 5-page essay and be done with it, right? But it's really amazing all the things that lead up to just getting into the U.S. Amateur alone. I mean, it's the biggest amateur championship in the world. There's a lot riding on that one event for amateur golfers, you know, mostly collegians, although I played some mid-amateurs at the time. And it was just one of those moments that really, you know, there's just a lot of build up to it because, you know, I was fortunate enough. I played pretty well in the previous U.S. Amateur in 95. I played in the semifinals, which actually got me that automatic berth into that 96 U.S. Amateur. And I also qualified for the U.S. Open just before that U.S. Amateur as well in 1996. So a lot of things really have to happen leading into that. But for me, one of the stories of the book, I mean, there's lots of underlying things, but my parents were divorced when I was 13 and I moved away from South Florida where I knew. And, you know, I went to a place just for my eighth grade year in the northwest corner of Arkansas and then Memphis, Tennessee. I lived in two places my eighth grade year. And so it was hard to make friends. And so golf was my friend. Golf was there for me. I was able to go to the course and kind of blow off some steam. And, you know, whereas other kids may turn to alcohol or drugs or who knows what, I turned to golf. And so golf was my friend at the time. And so, you know, fast forward to that moment, on the 34th hole in reverse way, you know, because golf was there for me as a youngster and I felt like I had to be there for the game. And so that moment, I was there for the game and upheld the integrity and the honor of the game of golf and really showed in that moment in an instinctive reflex action why golf is the game that it is and the game that we all love to play.
Now, you're a PGA pro at the current time, and do you look at competitive golf or instruction of the youth more important and more satisfying to you in your golf career?
Without question. I mean, you know, I was a traditional head pro for about 9 years up in the Northeast, New Jersey, New York, at a few different places. My role now, I don't teach quite as much, although I do get out there and help for sure. It's getting this message to everyone in the world, let alone the junior golf community alone, who it's really, I feel very compelled to tell this story to them, because, you know, this is, you know, if anybody's growing up now, they might watch the Farmers Insurance Open a few months ago and saw Patrick Reed do what he did. They might see other sports where people try to get away with as much as they can until a referee blows a whistle, or, the cycling world. I mean, we could go on in so many sports of how people try to bend and break the rules and cheat the game in a way. And you know, that's really the message that I want to spread to the world, really. And I'm lining up a lot of book talks and signings all around the country, you know, whether it's the First Tee, whether it's big member guests or whatnot. I mean, it's getting out there and making sure people know this story. 25 years later, this is the 25th anniversary of that match. And so, you know, for people to understand and really carry this message on, and how, and just to remind them how golf is this separator of all other sports, and why if you're a junior and you're teetering between one sport and another, you know, this is why you should go down the road of golf, because it has this great lifelong lessons that are really entrenched in the game.
What a great answer. Steve Scott is the guest, author of Hey Tiger, Move Your Mark Back.
And, you know, Steve, you talked about golf is one of those sports where, you know, rules and sportsmanship collide all the time. And, you know, really, what are the lessons that you think someone can learn from your story, really?
Well, I mean, number one, I mean, the perseverance, number one. I mean, I think that's a big thing. I mean, for me, in that U.S. Amateur alone, I shouldn't even have been in match play. I shot, you know, guess what I shot the first day of stroke play? Just take a while.
112.
No, you 75. Would have gotten me by a shot there in that round. But no, I shot 79 the first day of stroke play. Yeah, I'm in 242nd place after day one.
Yeah.
And mind you, that only the top 64 make the match play. And so I had to go out and perform kind of miracles in the second round. I went out and shot 500 par 66 on the secondary golf course and made it in by a shot. And with all the pressure on the line, everything really riding on that one round, and every moment being very important, every putt being so crucial, you know, I overcame that first round and persevered. So that's one lesson. Another lesson, certainly, you know, that 34th hole of the match, the sportsmanship of the match, the just making sure that, you know, being there for the game and having that moment where you didn't let winning get in the way of doing the right thing. I think that's probably the biggest lesson of this whole book. And yeah, it's this, and I think the timing of this story really is, I don't know, I guess in the where we are in the world, right? I mean, the world needs some feel good stories, I think, from, you know, what we've seen all over the map with everything. And so with health and politics and whatnot, you know, it's just, we want some, this good feel good story, and remind us the greatness of sport and the greatness of golf. And here I am. Timing is pretty good.
It's very good. And I think as the golf boom has happened here over the last 12 to 18 months, while you were holed away writing your book, the rest of the world was golfing. talk about irony there. But I think that your story is necessary for youth to hear, those that are trying to get into the sport. But your story is also very important for the any golfer to hear. And your statement, I didn't let winning get in the way of sportsmanship. I mean, that's going to be my takeaway, just as a quick FYI for you, Mike. I'm taking that one.
All right,
you're out.
Fine.
but you don't think your life would be much different and you don't think your personality and the way you see life and golf and all those things would be much different today had you beat Tiger that day, do you?
I don't think so. I mean, I think if you Google the match and you watch, you just look at my facial expression. Roger Maltby was interviewing us just following the match, and you look at my facial expressions. You listen to my tone and what I said. I mean, I left everything out there that day. I mean, I left. I played my best game that I could play under the most pressure that I could be under. I mean, NBC national television cameras following our every step, 15,000 people on the grounds. I mean, this was history. Tiger Woods turned pro the next day, and I was his last amateur conquest, if that sounds good at all. But the it was that. To be in that moment, I mean, you think of the probabilities of getting paired up and getting all the way down to the final match. You mentioned at the beginning, there's 5,000 people try to qualify for the U.S. Amateur, and you think of you and you're in the finals. Oh, and by the way, you're playing Tiger Woods for history. And it's just it was just a great moment in time. And so proud of everything I did that day, the way I played, the way I upheld the game. And, it's something that there's no regrets or anything. And if I did regret it, I wouldn't be here talking to you today. I'd be hauled up some padded cubicle somewhere and it wouldn't be pretty.
Yeah, you'd be with Shane. I had a follow-up question to you. I just missed it because I was making fun of producer Shane there.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I got it now. When you were told after your 79 and then the next day coming out and firing 66 and then you finally whittled it down and you're with the top two, at what point did they say, oh, a great job, great round, that's really exciting. Also, you play Tiger. What did you think at that moment? Because he was still an amateur, but he was Tiger Woods. There's no doubt. This was his third run at this. He was Tiger Woods at that point. What were your feelings and emotions going into that final match?
Well, I felt here's the story I love to tell about this moment. Number one, I was playing so well. I was just on this autopilot run. I was just the hole seemed as big as a peach basket. Like the greens were so perfect. I was rolling everything in. I was so confident. One of the things that happens when you make it to the finals of the U.S. Amateur, you know that you're going to get an invite to play the Masters next spring. Yeah, automatically. I've automatically won. And so knowing that, it kind of frees you up a little bit. Obviously, there's more carrots at the end of the stick when you win the U.S. Amateur. But walking down the very first hole, 7:15 in the morning, and I knew it was not going to be an ordinary Sunday morning when I saw the first hole is about 420 yard par four, and it was lined side a whole way around with people at 7:15 in the morning when everybody should have been asleep or at church or something. They were out there watching the match, and so it was just this moment that will be burned into my brain forever. And it was an electric moment. But as Tiger and I were walking down the first hole, and this speaks to the level of the confidence that I had. He was walking about 15 yards ahead of me. We both hit it in good shape off the first tee. And I noticed for the first time that his sports psychologist, Jay Brunza, who had caddied for him in all his previous USGA finals, was not on the bag. And I turned to Christy, who was my girlfriend at the time, now my wife for going on 22 years now. And I said, he doesn't have a sports psychologist with him. I'm going to crush this guy. He has no chance. And that was my mindset. And, if it was stroke play, I actually would have beat him. But unfortunately, we were playing match play that day. So kind of like the electoral college versus the popular vote.
Steve, why do you think golf is such a great vehicle for teaching youth about life and how to be a good person, not only on the course, but off of it?
Well, I think in golf, there are so many scenarios that you get in the course of a round of golf. And every one of them seems to be different than the previous one. Every one seems to be different than something you did yesterday or the week before. And so you learn how, number one, you learn how to kind of stay in the present and stay You have to stay calm and very even keeled to play well in golf, which kind of hurt me when I was younger because I was very hot and cold with my emotions. And so when I was hot, I mean, it was like, I mean, like a dumpster fire. I was hot. Like I was burning. I mean, I was great. But if when I was not on, it was really a detriment to my game. And so I've learned over time that, you know, to be more even keeled has been really more beneficial to my game. I think that's what golf teaches you. It teaches you to do the right thing when nobody's looking. It teaches you that you're out there playing by yourself and your ball moves, like, hey, you gotta count that as a stroke, or you gotta call a penalty, or it teaches you so many morals that are so beneficial in life. And then it's a lifelong game too, right? From ages 5 to 85, you can play this game and enjoy it. And we saw Gary Player out there and Jack Nicklaus on the first tee at the mat. I mean, Gary Player is doing scissor kicks off the first tee the other day in the opening ceremonies there at the Masters. And so it's one of those games that it's just that lifelong game that really, it just teaches you everything because of all the different situations you get in.
Adam knows all about that whole dumpster fire scenario. So just so you know.
I've only been thinking about all the times I screwed up. I didn't even hear his answer. I just was thinking about that.
Maybe a bonfire would have been a better word. Yeah.
You founded the Silver Club Golfing Society. What is that? And how does it compete with Stick and Hack? And should we be worried?
No worry at all, because the Silver Club Golfing Society is a national golf society. The name really stems from the very first competition on record back in 1744 over in Scotland, where the gentlemen golfers of Leith played for the right to put their name on a golf ball and they attached it to a silver club all the way back in 1744. And so we took that nod to the competitive origins of the game and infused that in our name. But single-digit handicaps are what we shoot for, and we travel around the country and play some wonderful golf courses, anywhere from Quaker Ridge to Pasatiempo to Prairie Dunes to, I mean, basically anywhere you want to play golf that's really good and architecturally significant and compelling, that's where we get to go. We run about 15 to 20 events a year, but just for low handicap players and who like to compete but travel and have some camaraderie infused with their experience of traveling too.
Well,
can I join?
I'll never be a part
What's
of
your handicap?
He's the stick.
I'm a zero.
He's a zero. I'm good zero. For him.
You're the stick?
Yeah, he's the stick.
Yes. Yeah. Perfect. We're done. Automatic.
Awesome.
We're all very impressed.
Perfect.
Steve Scott, your book, Hey Tiger, Move Your Mark Back, comes out May 18th. What an incredible story. And we could probably talk to you for much longer. I know it's got to be annoying. And I should have apologized on the outset here to every answer has to go back to Tiger. I know that sucks. But you get it, right? You understand why that is the case. I mean, you did write a book about it.
I've gotten it for 25 years. So.
your life is so many other things. And that's, I think one of the first questions I asked you was the reason why is does that annoy you? But you mentioned something, your girlfriend at the time, who was your caddy, and married to today, you've got a beautiful, wonderful family and a great career and just all the success in the world continued for you, sir. We are we're proud of what you did on that day, but I think more specifically proud of how that shaped you, probably shaped your kids and your family over the next 20 years or so. Really, really awesome.
No, thank you. Thank you guys so much. I mean, I think that, yeah, the book, it's great to talk about the competition and the link with Tiger, but the book is also a love story too.
Right.
I mean, how many people have had their girlfriend caddy for them in maybe the biggest golf match in the history of golf? Not very many, if any. So, and I wouldn't ordinarily give advice to marrying your caddy because, you know, some of them don't bathe and whatnot, but no, but I'm just kidding. But in my case, it worked out beautifully. And, Christy's wonderful. The two kids are great. JC and Kaylee, and we're just, we're having a great time in life and getting them in the game and teaching them all, passing down all these great values that the game teaches us. And that's, that's the best thing I can do as a father.
That's awesome. Steve Scott is the guest. The book, Hey Tiger, Move Your Mark Back, comes out May 18th. You can visit him at stevescottpga.com, Instagram and Twitter, at sscottpga. You're going to stick around and play a game with us here in a second, yes? Play in or out?
I will. You can also find the book at movethatback.com as well. So
movethatback.com, as well as wherever you get your books. Hopefully there's still the bookstores out there, and you can go there. All right, Steve, we'll be back in just a second, okay? All right, so takeaway time, Mike. I mean, yeah. I'm going to let you go first, but if you take mine, which I already preemptively told you what it's going to be.
You go first this time.
My takeaway, without question, the number one thing that you can learn from this story, from him, from this interview, is don't let winning get in the way of sportsmanship. Yeah. Mic drop, end of discussion, period, story over. Don't let winning get in the way of sportsmanship.
I think for me, and this is something that I think really his first answer around it was instinctual. To me, that's the takeaway, is like golf is one of those, is a game that teaches you these things from the beginning, that they're ingrained in you and you almost just don't even think about it, which I think when we see some of the things that we've seen happen on the tour with someone who will not be named,
Patrick Reed.
Yeah. It drives me insane, because we know how the game is taught and what you're supposed to do. And it teaches you to do the right thing. And when you see guys not do it, it's disappointing. But, I think it's that it's instinctual, because like what he talked about, I know I've done the same thing 1,000 times when I'm playing golf with somebody, they move their mark and then, you know, I may just be standing there and then they're getting ready to putt and I'll casually, hey, did you move your mark back before they putt? You know, and it's just one of those things that it's ingrained in you from a young age when you're in the game. So, yeah.
And there's so many rules in golf, and this is for the sticks and hacks out there. There are so many rules specifically for the hacks, but there are a lot of sticks that don't know all the rules. There's so many rules of the game, so many nuances that it is sometimes you're not cheating to cheat. You're not doing it on purpose. You just don't know the rule. Right, I had an instance one time where I was, and this was before they changed the rule, where I was in a yellow or a red or you know green, whatever the hell.
It's called a hazard.
Great,
it's good. Called a hazard.
Yeah, whatever the paint color was, and there's different rules for what you can do in different paint colored areas. Right, that's the way I'm putting it.
That is the most hack explanation of a golf rule,
right? Ever. But you understand, and I did something wrong. I hit something on the way back. Yeah. Did you see the story? And I'm getting off on a tangent here, but did you see the story this just a couple weeks ago at one of the tournaments that he hit a on his takeaway? He was in this like rock area, and he hit a reed.
It was from the RBC from a few years ago.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah, I think it was Brian David.
Yeah,
maybe?
Yeah. And
he was in a playoff.
He was in a playoff, and he hit. Yeah. You're right. And
he hit a reed. Club, and he called himself on it.
Yeah. Correct. And it was a two shot, and he ended up losing. Yep. Obviously, yep. That's the type of thing that doesn't get enough play in golf. And so the second or third takeaway here is to read this book and to read it with the not just oh my god, this guy got beat by Tiger and played Tiger and blah blah blah, but the love story that it is, love story for golf, love story for him and his wife, and the love story of just humanity, right? And being a good sport and bringing golf in. So it's fantastic. The book is Steve Scott and Hey Tiger, Move Your Mark Back, the guest today. Steve, you're back, and let's play in or out. Sound good?
Let's do it.
All right, so the topic here is bad men of the 90s NBA. So we've been talking a lot about all the good people, so we figured the bad men of the 90s NBA. Okay, in or out of our foursome?
So some of these are questionable. I don't know, we'll see.
All right. Well,
let's see what we think.
The good part of the game is that you can say
in or out. Bad men.
Oh, no. You
should have used the bad boys.
Well, oh, God. This is like a meeting with Shane right now. We're live on the show, Mike. If you want to do this in the pre-prod meeting, please do that next time. Here we go. In or out, bad men of the 90s NBA, asterisk. Number one, John Stockton. In or out? Steve.
In.
I'll go with in.
In. Charles Oakley.
I don't know him enough, so I'll say out. He's probably out. He's bad. He's bad. He's pretty bad. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. I remember him.
Yeah,
he was kind of angry.
Oakley was a bad man.
He was a bad dude.
Yep.
He might have a single card. Yeah.
Yeah.
He can be in, but you got to ride by yourself and play a whole ahead.
Yeah.
Reggie Miller.
In.
Yeah, he's in the John Stead. Yeah, he's in for sure.
In. All right, Rodman. Say it.
Rodman's in for me.
Thank you.
I think he's in just for the entertainment.
Yeah, value. Absolutely.
Sure, no question. Absolutely.
Rodman is in. Isaiah Thomas.
I'm gonna go out.
I think he's in the Phil Mickelson category. I'm gonna say out.
We'll get to that in a second.
that's the greatest answer ever.
I say out as well. Isaiah Thomas is out. Yeah. And just out of curiosity, what'd you mean by that?
I don't know. We'll leave it there.
I think it's all clear.
That'll be an off air conversation.
Yeah. Isaiah Thomas.
We just did that.
Yep. Bill Laimbeer.
Laimbeer's in for me, yeah. Oof. Although my grandma would be really mad because she hated Bill Laimbeer back in the 90s.
Bill Laimbeer?
Yeah, I think if you made a putt against Bill Laimbeer, it'd have to be a long putt because then you'd have to, like, run away because you'd have to, like, you know, he'd be blocking you out and trying to knock you in the bunkers.
Well, during the last dance, I thought that maybe after 20 years he had mellowed a little bit, and in the last dance documentary, he was still harboring
some resentment. Stuff.
There was still some angst in the Laimbeer camp. Latrell Sprewell, in or out?
Out.
Out, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, Latrell's out for me.
Out. All right, this is Patrick Ewing.
He's in for me.
Yeah, in.
I like Patrick.
Out.
Okay.
He was probably one of the most hated by me players in all of NBA history.
Okay.
Michael Jordan.
And kidding me.
Easy. Yeah, for sure. In all day.
All right, in. Allen Iverson.
And I would just try to see if I could get him to practice.
Of course you would. Of course you would.
Yeah.
Talk about practice.
He'd be fun too. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, he wouldn't be on the range though.
He comes up. Hey, Allen, you going to the range? We're talking about practice. Oh, man. Do you have something that you wanted to say about this list? Because in my mind, those are all bad boys, bad men of the NBA. The 90s NBA.
Michael Jordan wasn't a bad guy.
Oh, BS.
All right, maybe he was.
Watch The Last Dance.
I mean, Reggie Miller did get in a fight. So nah, sure.
Being a bad man of the 90s NBA didn't mean just getting into fights.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It is just that whole persona.
Yeah. I'm with you.
Okay.
I'm with you. Like, sorry, he's a bad man.
Sorry about that.
That type of thing?
No. Yeah, exactly. Right. Steve Scott. Thank you, sir, for your time today. I hope you enjoyed the program. Go buy his book. It's out May 18th. It's called Hey Tiger, Move Your Mark Back, and moveyourmarkback.com.
Move that back.
Right.
Move that back.
Move that back.
Move that back.
Move that back.com. As well as where you get your books, and follow him online and on social media at @scottpga. A great story, a great man. Thank you so much for your time today, and thanks for being a member of Stick and Hack.
Thank you, guys. Thanks,
all right, we'll talk to you later. All right, there he goes. Go to stickandhack.com and become a member of the world's greatest golf club without the course. Don't forget to check out our other shows on the Stick and Hack Podcast Network. That would be Business of Golf and the Stick and Hack Reacts every Monday. Thanks so much, Mike. Have a good day. Proud of you. See you.
Proud of you, buddy. Peace out, guys.
Okay, we're done. This has been the Stick and Hack Show. Go to stickandhack.com to become a free member of the world's greatest golf club without the course.